Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Ann Ball, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a court in Pakistan announced Tuesday that former president and military ruler Pervez Musharraf is guilty of high treason. The court sentenced him to death. The treason charge was tied to Musharraf's declaration of emergency rule in 2007. It is the first time a Pakistani court has tried and convicted a military leader. Musharraf came to power after the military ousted the government in 1999. The treason case has been moving through the courts since 2014, when Musharraf was charged. He has been in Dubai for medical treatment since 2016. Pakistani justice officials have asked the former president to return and answer questions in court several times. But he has said he could not return for medical reasons. Earlier this month, from a hospital in Dubai, Musharraf expressed his distrust in the judicial process. He described himself as a victim of it. The major opposition parties in Pakistan praised the court decision as protection against future military overthrows. The country has spent more than half of its existence under direct military rule. Bilawal Bhutto Zardari is the leader of the Pakistan People's Party. He is the son of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, who was murdered in 2007. He wrote on Twitter Tuesday, "Democracy is the best revenge." Pakistan's government, considered close to the military, did not issue an official statement on the conviction. However, at least one government minister expressed concerns about the court's decision. "We need to unite the country. Why take decisions that divide the nation and its institutions?" wrote Fawad Chaudhry, the Minister for Science and Technology.
Aerospace company Boeing's announcement that it is suspending production of the 737 MAX passenger jet is affecting more than just the business's financial results. Thousands of employees and hundreds of suppliers are also facing an unclear future with the production freeze. Boeing's biggest in 20 years. Boeing builds the 737 MAX in Seattle, Washington. About 12,000 employees are involved in making the airplane. The company said it would not lay off employees during the production freeze. However, the move will affect a supply chain of up to 900 companies in the U.S. and overseas that make parts for the complex jet. Boeing's board of directors made the decision Monday, after a two-day meeting. Last week, the Federal Aviation Administration did not approve the 737's return to service before 2020. The 737 MAX passenger airplane has been banned from flying since March, shortly after a second deadly crash involving the aircraft took place near Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. 5 months earlier, one of the jets crashed after taking off from Jakarta, Indonesia. A total of 346 people died in the two incidents. The crashes caused an international outcry against Boeing, and many questioned the company's support for safety policies. Pilots reportedly had expressed concerns about one of the flight control systems on the plane. It caused the aircraft to lose altitude under some conditions. Boeing has made changes to the airplane's software and proposed upgrading pilot training. But the changes are still being studied by flight safety officials. The Federal Aviation Administration would not comment on what it described as Boeing's business decision. It said it would continue to work with safety officials around the world to study the proposed changes to the 737 MAX. Our first priority is safety, and we have set no time frame for when the work will be completed, the agency said. The production freeze signals a deepening of the crisis for Boeing. U.S. Representative Rick Larson called the decision a body blow to its workers and the region's economy. The lawmaker, however, praised Boeing's promise not to lay off workers. Before Monday, Boeing had not stopped production of the 737 MAX during the months-long grounding. The company said that it had about 400 airplanes in storage waiting to be sent to buyers. It is estimated that the grounding has cost Boeing about $9 billion so far, and about $1 billion each additional month. Boeing's production halt also affects suppliers, like Spirit AeroSystems Holdings, Inc., based in Wichita, Kansas. 50% of the company's sales are based on the 737 MAX. Other companies that supply parts to Boeing are Britain's Senior PLC and France's Safran SA. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
As the United States explores ways to deal with shootings at schools, some Americans argue more people should carry guns. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, President Donald Trump told the National Rifle Association in April. More states are giving teachers permission to carry guns, he said, and who better to protect our children
than our teachers who love them. But a look at unintentional shootings by law enforcement officers, including some at schools, raises questions about whether more guns would help keep students safe.
The Associated Press, AP, investigated the issue. It found that accidental shootings happen at law enforcement agencies of all sizes across the country every year. The AP examined public records and media reports. It found 1,422 unintentional shootings by officers at 258 agencies since 2012. 22 of these shootings happened at schools or colleges. The National School Boards Association reports that at least 9 states have passed laws enabling employees to carry guns on school grounds. The schools taught children from kindergarten, generally for ages 4 to 6, through high school. The group noted that 19 states give anyone with permission from a school administration official to carry a gun at school.
Experts say anybody carrying guns, including teachers, needs ongoing intensive training to control their arms expertly and react the right way in stressful settings. But many law enforcement officers do not even get that. Doug Tangen is firearms program manager at the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission, the state's police training center. He said that most people, including police officers, do not have enough training to be able to shoot or carry a firearm responsibly. The AP's investigation confirmed 6 accidental shootings that involved officers reacting to reports of active shooters.
One such shooting happened in 2016 at the Alpine High School in the town of Alpine, Texas. When a call came in about 2 shooters inside the school, local, state, and federal officers hurried there. Homeland Security Investigations Special Agent John Dangle was shot and injured just outside a classroom. U.S. Marshal Douglas Mullins later admitted he had accidentally fired his weapon. The AP found other accidental shootings at schools happened while officers chased or arrested suspects, taught gun safety classes, or attended school events while off duty. In some cases, officers, teachers, or students were injured.
Experts say the way to avoid these accidents includes following rules for safe use of guns and training regularly in settings that seem like real life. Alan Gottlieb started a group called the Second Amendment Foundation in Bellevue, Washington. The Second Amendment to the United States Constitution protects the right of individuals to keep and carry arms. Gottlieb supports arming teachers as a way to prevent violence. He says schools without guns are a target-rich environment for people who are crazy. Yet many educators have resisted the idea that they should carry guns.
In 2018, a group called Teach Plus asked more than 1,200 teachers about being armed at schools, and 80% said they were strongly opposed. Also last year, the National Education Association, the country's largest teachers' union, asked about 1,000 members if they would be willing to carry a gun in school, even with training, and 82% said no. We reject the idea that putting more guns in schools will make schools safer, the group's president, Lily Eskelson Garcia, told the AP. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On April 9, 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to Union General Ulysses Grant. Within weeks, the Civil War would be over. When people in Washington learned of Lee's surrender, they hurried to the White House. The crowd wanted to hear from President Abraham Lincoln. The speech he gave would be one of his last, as Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe explained in our series.
President Lincoln spoke several days after General Lee's surrender. The people expected a victory speech, but Lincoln gave them something else. Already, he was moving forward from victory to the difficult times ahead. The Southern Rebellion was over. Now, he faced the task of rebuilding the Union. Lincoln did not want to punish the South. He wanted to rejoin the ties that the Civil War had broken. So, when the people of the North expected a speech of victory, he gave them a speech of reconstruction instead. On the night of April 11th, Lincoln appeared before a crowd outside the White House. He held a candle in one hand and his speech in the other.
Fellow citizens, Lincoln said, we meet this evening not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart. The surrender of the main army of the Confederacy gives hope of a righteous and speedy peace. The joy cannot be held back. By these recent successes, we have had pressed more closely upon us the question of reconstruction. We all agree, Lincoln continued, that the so-called seceded states are out of their correct relation with the Union. We also agree that what the government is trying to do is get these states back into their correct relation. I believe it is not only possible, but in fact easier, to do this without deciding the legal question of whether these states have ever been out of the Union. Finding themselves safely at home, it would be of no importance whether they had ever been away.
There was cheering and applause when President Lincoln finished, but less than when he began. The speech had been too long and too detailed to please the crowd. Lincoln, however, believed it a success. He hoped he had made the country understand one thing: the great need to forget hatred and bitterness in the difficult time of rebuilding that would follow the war. The president continued to discuss his ideas on Reconstruction over the next few days. On Friday, April 14th, he agreed to put this work aside for a while. In the afternoon, he took his wife, Mary, for a long drive away from the city. In the evening, they would go to the theater.
One of the popular plays of the time, called Our American Cousin, was being performed at Ford's Theater, not far from the White House. The Secretary of War did not want the Lincolns to go alone. He ordered an army officer to go with them. The President and Mrs. Lincoln sat in special seats at Ford's Theater. The presidential box was above and to one side of the stage. A guard always stood outside the door to the box. On this night, however, the guard did not remain. He left the box unprotected.
President Lincoln settled down in his seat to enjoy the play. As he did so, a man came to the door of the box. He carried a gun in one hand and a knife in the other. The man entered the presidential box quietly. He slowly raised the gun. He aimed it at the back of Lincoln's head. He fired. Then the man jumped from the box to the stage, 3 meters below. Many in the theater recognized him. He was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he hit the stage floor, but he pulled himself up, shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus ever to tyrants, and ran out the door. He got on a horse and was gone.
The attack was so quick that the audience did not know what had happened. Then a woman shouted, "The president has been shot." Lincoln had fallen forward in his seat, unconscious. Someone asked if it was possible to move him to the White House. A young army doctor said no. The president's wound was terrible. He would die long before reaching the White House. So Lincoln was moved to a house across the street from Ford's Theater. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from the president's head. He could not. Nothing could be done except wait. The end was only hours away.
Cabinet members began to arrive, while wild reports spread through the city. The Confederates had declared war again. There was fighting in the streets. An official of the War Department described the situation. The extent of the plot was unknown. From so horrible a beginning, what might come next? How far would the bloody work go? The safety of Washington must be looked after. The people must be told. The assassin and his helpers must be captured.
Early the next morning, April 15th, Abraham Lincoln died. A prayer was said over his body. His eyes were closed. The news went out by telegraph to cities and towns across the country. People read the words but could not believe them. To millions of Americans, Abraham Lincoln's death was a personal loss. They had come to think of him as more than the President of the United States. He was a trusted friend. People hung black cloth on their doors in sorrow. Even the South mourned for Lincoln, its former enemy. Southern General Joe Johnston said, "Mr. Lincoln was the best friend we had. His death is the worst thing that could happen for the South."
Messages of regret came from around the world. British labor groups said they could never forget the things Lincoln had said about working people, things such as, "The strongest tie of human sympathy should be one uniting all working people of all nations and tongues." A group representing hundreds of French students sent this message: "In President Lincoln, we mourn a fellow citizen. There are no longer any countries shut up in narrow frontiers. Our country is everywhere where there are neither masters nor slaves. Wherever people live in liberty or fight for it, we look to the other side of the ocean to learn how a people which has known how to make itself free knows how to preserve its freedom." The assassination of Abraham Lincoln touched the imagination of America's writers. Many tried to put their feelings into words. Walt Whitman wrote several poems of mourning. Here is part of one of them: "O Captain, my Captain."
"Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse, nor will. The ship is anchored, safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead."
Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in the spring. That is the time of year when lilac plants burst into flower throughout much of the United States. One of Walt Whitman's most beautiful poems in honor of Lincoln is called "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed." Here is part of that poem:
"When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. Ever-returning spring, Trinity sure to me you bring, lilac, blooming perennial and drooping star in the west, and thought of him I love. Coffin that passes through lanes and streets, through day and night with the great cloud darkening the land, with the countless torches lit, with the silent sea of faces and the unbared heads, with the tolling, tolling bells' perpetual clang, here, coffin that slowly passes, I give you my sprig of lilac."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.